The episode this week is brought to you by Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide by simplifying selling online and in person so that you can successfully grow your business. Shopify covers all of your sales channels and even gets you selling across social media marketplaces like Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. Full of the industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth, Shopify gives you complete control over your business and your brand without learning new skills in design and coding. And thanks to 24/7 help and with an extensive business course library, Shopify is ready to support your success every step of the way. Now, I remember a side hustle I set up a few years in Devon. It was so difficult actually selling the product and getting paid. Changing everything took me ages and ages and ages. A friend recommended Shopify, and it completely transformed the business. It just made everything so easy, leaving me to focus on the important stuff. And that's what I love about Shopify, that no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify will be there to empower you with the confidence and control to take your business to the next level. It's time to get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/truecrime, all lowercase. Go to shopify.co.uk/truecrime to take your business to the next level today. shopify.co.uk/truecrime. Hello and welcome to episode 389 of the UK True Crime Podcast. I'm Adam. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today for my latest episode, which concentrates on the drugs trade and a gang responsible for large-scale importations. But this lot won't hide in their stuff in boxes of oranges or trying to get through airports. No, they weren't old school. And with the strategy and plans they used and the luxury lifestyles this work funded, they thought they'd cracked it. Before we start, just one other thing. If you haven't got tickets yet for my live shows with Mike from Murder Mile and Paul from the True Crime Enthusiast podcast, which take place at Customs House South Shields on the 2nd of June, or at the Glee Club in Birmingham on the 3rd of June, these tickets are now on sale at the venues or at my website, uktruecrime.com. Remember, the first round is on you. Right, let's set some context for today's story with our guest the month and year game. At number 2 in the UK charts, it was the Trouser Snake with Mirrors. Taylor Swift was at number 6 in the US charts with I Knew You Were Trouble. And the Bublé. The Bublé was at 4 in the Australian album charts with To Be Loved. In the news this month, 24 people were killed after a double-decker bus veered off for a pass in Cape Town, South Africa. The final BBC news bulletins were transmitted from Television Centre after 43 years of occupying the building as the corporation moved its entire news operation to Broadcasting House in central London. Ah, the nostalgia. Those days when people used to watch the BBC. And in UK true crime news, politician Chris Hughne and Vicky Price were both jailed for 8 months for perverting the course of justice over speeding offences. This was one of the less interesting cases I covered in an earlier episode. Hey, I'm just being honest. This month also saw the death of sports commentator Tony Gubber, a staple of my life for so many years, at just 69 from leukemia. Okay, so did you get the month and year? It's a tricky one, I think, as astonishingly, Michael Bublé was in a chart and it wasn't Christmas. I know, right? It was in fact March 2013. Did you get it? Okay, so on with our story. It was Liverpool Crown Court in March 2013 that saw 58-year-old Philip Barron plead guilty to importing cocaine and cannabis and money laundering. He was caught after a 5-year joint police probe called Operation Beef, a 5-year investigation by the Serious Organised Crime Agency, or SOCA, that spanned 22 UK and international police forces. SOCA said that the smuggling operation was among the 10 biggest ever uncovered in the UK. It saw in total 89 arrests and 30 people sentenced for various offences. Passing sentence on Barron, the judge said that he, along with other members of his operation, sold the drugs on a commercial scale so you could lead the life you did. He continued, "It was driven by avarice and greed. It was a trade and an empire, and you cared not for the lives of others. You may have destroyed lives. It may have led people to commit crime. It may have led to despair and desperation. None of that concerned you. You were only concerned with yourself and leading a lavish lifestyle. It was quite a fall from grace for Baron, who at the time was living with his wife Elaine and his two model children, that is fashion models, in a whopping mansion in Ireland, backing onto the exclusive five-star resort, the K Club, which you may remember hosted the 2006 Ryder Cup. He also owned a luxury place in Spain, of course, and also in the northwest of England. Baron did all those things you'd expect from a respectable and upstanding member of the community, driving a Bentley GT Continental and attending black tie charity dinners where he always donated generously. His two children, the models by his second marriage to Elaine, were looked after with trust funds in locations from Switzerland to Uzbekistan. But these were actually set up by the specialist money launderer in his drugs gang. His neighbours, and even it's thought his family, believed that he'd made his money through a business renting tech chairs on the Costa del Sol. It just shows once again what we all know, how the extreme wealth we see is often built on a facade of respectability. But Baron's roots were humble, having started life in Salford, where he initially worked as an HGV driver and then he owned a business cleaning tankers in Trafford Park. It did okay, but it was never going to make him a multimillionaire, and it was the money and the lifestyle that he wanted. But just how had Baron managed to be quite so successful financially anyway as he had? Well, Baron, who is known as 4X or 4by because of his liking for SUVs, sorry, this podcast this week is full of cliches, I do apologise, he'd found an unusual way of smuggling drugs into the UK. None of this hassle of trying to get cases through airports or lorries full of oranges. Instead, he used freight and courier companies to send consignments to 12 addresses in cities across Britain, rented from office service companies. The drugs came from North Africa and South America via Spain. There was at least one delivery a month where Baron's gang packed drugs into a box, which was labelled as a technical manual or maybe printed material, and sent to legitimate and unconnected UK organisations. It was a slick organisation, as soon as the package had arrived, another of the group, another member of the gang, would come to collect the drugs and then distribute them to a network of lower level dealers in major cities including Birmingham, Glasgow, Liverpool and Manchester. Baron smuggled cannabis into the UK as his bread and butter, but occasionally his gang would import cocaine as a cash boost to pay for luxury items. Alongside this operation, millions of pounds of cash were laundered from a base in Wimslow in Cheshire, which we'll hear about. As time went by and the gang didn't get caught, they began to feel they were invincible. The methods they used to avoid detection were really as you would expect from a dodgy crime novel. They wrote cryptic notes using numbers and letters, and they spoke in code on the phone. They used football terms to communicate, so tickets was code for drugs money and United was code for sterling. In total, Baron was involved in the importation of 60 kilos of cocaine in two shipments in November 2008 and about 32,000 kilos of cannabis from Africa via Spain in numerous shipments between 2005 and 2009. Baron had sourced the cocaine himself from Costa Rica after travelling there in November 2008. He did a decent job, if that's the expression, sourcing a top quality product, as when the cocaine was discovered by the authorities, it was found to be 83% purity. Bear in mind that street level seizures tend to have purities of below 10%. This, of course, meant more profit for him and the gang. But in reality, as we hear about all the drug smugglers featured on this podcast, not getting caught just isn't easy. And Baron had been under suspicion for a long time. In fact, back in 2008, the police were called when a Cheltenham office services company became suspicious about the sheer number of packages coming in for him. From here, detectives and Soccer began tracing the members of the gang and their activities, and there were some pretty obvious leads which we can best explain by looking at some of Barron's key people. It was back in the northwest of England 17 years earlier that he met Walter Callanan and Paul Yearsley, who were both to play key roles in his criminal empire. Barron had met Callanan when they were both lorry drivers, and they instantly got on well. Like all the best gang members, 60-year-old, at the time of arrest, Callanan, had a couple of nicknames, being known as JJ, as he often used the false name James Jones, among many others, including Big Fella. He based himself in the Spanish city of Malaga, coordinating consignments of cannabis and using the proceeds of the drugs to fund a credible lifestyle, which included a racehorse paid for under the name of JJ. This cost alone over £40,000 a year to maintain. Callanan was a big sports fan, and he was able to travel the world following the England football team, spending thousands on first-class travel and staying in the best hotels. I guess he probably was a member of that most strange club at Wembley, Club England. It was the actions, really, of Barron and Callanan that really sealed the end for these two main movers in the gang. Police tracked Barron and Callanan to Costa Rica, where they were contacting a Colombian drugs cartel who'd previously been responsible for importing cocaine to Spain. It's stopping people talking, isn't it, when you extend your network beyond those you know and trust well. Ironically, it was Callanan's very thoroughness which helped ensure that he was convicted. A ledger found at his Spanish home showed 86 transactions involving almost 17 tons of cannabis over 17 months, resulting in a profit of £3.2 million. This became a key piece of evidence in the case against the group. He was actually found to have £5 million in assets and 6 false passports when the police caught up with him, as you do. His calls when he was detained were, of course, recorded, but this didn't stop him speaking relatively openly. In one conversation to his son, he was heard saying that the authorities had fuck all on him. But in a later call to Barron, he realised that key documents had been found at the home of money launderer Malcolm Carl. More about him to come. His tone shifted significantly in a later call when he realised just how much evidence was stacked against the gang. Callanan was reported saying, "We're fucked on it, mate. They've got that much documentation. Fucking hell, the Pope wouldn't get out of it." To be fair to Callanan, he did show some loyalty to Barron when he knew the game was up. Now acting more in the way that had allowed them to be successful for so many years, not the naivety of not realising that his calls weren't being recorded, he tried to disguise a warning to him during a phone call. He urged him not to go to Spain, where he was sure he would be arrested, saying, "Be very wary of driving in these conditions, mate. You know the roads are terrible. You've got that other car, haven't you? You've got the four-wheel drive car you've got, the local plated one. I'd drive that, mate, if I was you. And I wouldn't go into the sun on your holidays anymore, mate. Definitely not." Callanan was sentenced to 11 years in prison in 2011 after pleading guilty to importing drugs. I mentioned a moment ago about the key money launderer for the group, Malcolm Carl. Let's find out a bit more about him. Of course, he needs a nickname, and the Manchester-based accountant was known as Sir Humphrey. Formerly working in IT at Barclays, Carl was 59 when he was arrested and living a luxury lifestyle in Wimslow, Cheshire. Carl charged a drugs gang 20p per mile to collect drugs payments, but also tried to double-cross them to further line his own pockets. He'd bought a £1.2 million pub to help launder some of the drugs money, the Hadley Green Bowling Inn near Worcester. Carl used the money to follow Chelsea Football Club around the world and drive a luxury Jaguar. But there was no escape when his home was raided, as police found evidence of a cash receipt of £973,000 and details on the purchase of the hotel. They also found large quantities of unexplained cash, and they uncovered a complex network of trusts and overseas companies. In fact, Carl had done a decent job, as the web of companies was so well hidden that Soccer failed to find all of them. One letter found at Carl's house showed documents for a trust were concealed in Azerbaijan. Other firms were set up in the British Virgin Islands and the Seychelles. Police found messages from Carl to Callinan regarding the hotel purchase, which actually said it had been bought with, and I quote, dirty money, and was meant to be a hidden and long-term investment. He was at least honest in his records, as he referred to its transfer abroad as to, again, I quote, hide the way the funds were raised. When interviewed, Carl at first denied all knowledge of the scams, but he later admitted the company he'd set up, MTC Law, was just a big front. He admitted it was all dodgy and said he wasn't happy with what he had done. Callinan's importation of cannabis to the office in Cheltenham, if you recall, that first put Soccer onto the gang and generated almost £1 million of cash, this was found recorded, the details were recorded in Carl's accounts. They found that on occasions between December 2007 and November 2011, Carl had picked up cash amounts ranging from £25,000 to £100,000 from dodgy deals, totalling £593,000. Carl had a 20% stake in the hotel, and other notes showed him receiving more than £58,000 in cash. Carl had told Callinan that his money taken from the business were limited and the hotel itself barely broke even, but this didn't add up compared to the life of luxury he was leading. In July 2007, Carl even ripped off the gang, as he used his position as the sole director of the English firm which appeared to own the Hadley Hotel to secure a £1 million loan for a separate personal property deal from which he hoped to make £200,000 profit. But things, of course, didn't go to plan, the deal went wrong, and only £500,000 of the loan was repaid. This was only realised in late 2008 when Callinan tried to remortgage the Hadley. He sent his son to talk to Carl, and with interest, the debt rose to £1.4 million, and the loan firm tried to enforce the seller of the Hadley to repay the money. Carl again kept detailed notes and entries in his diary and emails between the pair, showed they fell out over the finances of the hotel. But the money was just too good for anyone to totally walk away. Carl was jailed for 6 years at Winchester Crown Court after admitting 3 money laundering offences. Then there was Paul Yearsley. He'd worked for Tameside Metropolitan Borough Council as a recreation supervisor at a swimming pool when he met Barron. But in 1993, when he was just 28, he was unable to work again due to physical health issues. And yet, due to his interest in the drugs business, 16 years later, Yearsley had built up a multi-million pound property portfolio, including a whopping 80 homes around Manchester. That's more than Robbie Fowler. As well as a villa in the Costa del Sol. And boy, did he love to boast and show off about just how well he'd done for himself. I imagine he wasn't great fun at parties. In August 2009, he and his wife Carol invited Lancashire Magazine into his £6 million mansion, where the writer gushed about the luxurious house with roomfuls of wow factor, including a huge curved double staircase, marble floors, and a bespoke marble kitchen. Officers from Soccer were suspicious about how someone on his poor income was able to afford such wealth, and they were having none of the claims that he made cash selling firstly as a car salesman and then selling homes to Premier League footballers in the northwest of England. They trailed him and on one occasion watched at a retail park in Bolton, where he met 2 dealers and handed over 120 kilos of cannabis resin packed in 4 bales, which had been smuggled into the country from North Africa via Spain. When Yearsley was finally arrested on the 18th of December 2009, his wife and daughters had their bags packed to jet off to yet another luxury ski resort. Money, it's fair to say, wasn't an issue for this family. Yearsley was jailed at Manchester Crown Court for 5 years and 4 months after admitting conspiracy to supply Class B drugs. As usual, our authorities move at a snail's pace, and in 2013, when he was given a confiscation order to recover £340,000 of his drugs profits, he was already out of prison and living in another multi-million pound house. And who says crime doesn't pay? By the way, he had the nerve to appeal against the $340,000, but it still went ahead. Paul Hewitt was known as Spot and 55 at the time of his arrest. Along with Callinan, he was the main man on the ground in Spain, responsible for the packaging of drugs with the names of legitimate engineering or car component companies, and also renting space from office service companies in Britain to receive these packages. Like the others, Hewitt did very well out of the enterprise, and he loved to act the wealthy man around his playground of the Costa del Sol, including a 64-foot Sunseeker yacht and a brand new Porsche. Hewitt was sentenced to 20 years in the slammer for his role in importing drugs. We know that drug dealers use others for their own benefits, and this was the case with Barron too. He was estranged from his daughter from his first marriage, Rachel, until the birth of her first child, about 6 years before he was sent to jail. But whilst he left his two children from his second marriage out of the dirty dealings, within 6 weeks of regaining contact with Rachel, he had her on the payroll. On his instructions, Rachel spent almost £60,000 on 8 watches at a jeweller's in Altrincham in Cheshire. She also paid a deposit for a Bentley Continental GT Coupe at a car dealer in Leeds, with Philip Barron paying the balance of the purchase price by bank transfers. When she was caught, Rachel was sentenced to 3 years in prison for laundering over £1 million of drugs money. When she was in court, the QC opening the case to the prosecution told the court that a recording device had been placed in the home of Rachel Barron. He said the device recorded her saying that her dad was called Butlin because he had likened a Spanish prison he'd been in to a holiday camp. Let's go on to Barron's trial again. He'd fought extradition from Ireland to the UK for 2 years since May 2011, but finally he was brought to the UK and faced justice. At Philip Barron's trial, he admitted 3 counts, including conspiracy to import cocaine between March and November 2008, conspiracy to import cannabis between September 2005 and September 2009, and money laundering. The defending QC, Timothy Forte, said his client accepted he played an organising and leading role. He said Barron was a previous good character and had pleaded guilty at the earliest opportunity. Forte said that Barron had been making money from the cannabis enterprise and had dipped his toe into the cocaine market when he was asked to come in by another drugs kingpin as a troubleshooter. One interesting fact to emerge at his trial is that Barron didn't pay any tax in any country for 15 years. In the end, Barron was sentenced to 18 years in prison. After the trial, you can imagine that the authorities were all over the media. I guess with the appalling track record that soccer has, they should rightly celebrate every success, and it was a job well done. Steve Baldwin of Soccer said, "There's no doubt Barron and his associates were operating at the top end of organised crime. He lived a lavish lifestyle abroad, portraying himself as a legitimate businessman, while orchestrating the importation of huge amounts of drugs into the UK, and in particular the North West. They thought they were above the law, but we were one step ahead of them." Philip Barron was later brought back before the judge, who sentenced him for a proceeds of crime hearing so the authorities could seize back some of the profits. But get this, Barron, who was believed to have amassed a £29.5 million fortune, the only available assets that investigators could find totaled £112,000. Barron did not contest the hearing. He was probably unable to speak for laughing. And the judge ordered that the entire sum of £112,000, which involved £100,000 cash found in his possession and the rest seized in Ireland, be confiscated. If the money was not handed over in 3 months, he faced an extra 12 months in prison. Of course it was handed over. So what do you make of what we've heard today? Well, the way they transported drugs doesn't sound ingenious to me, does it you? Sounds like they just managed to get lucky for a while before they were caught. You can imagine it, I think, that once the first batch went through with no problems at all, it seemed easy, they kept on doing it and kept growing. With all the nicknames and other interesting points about the individuals involved in the case, at times it almost seems like a comedy crime film from Guy Ritchie or similar. You almost need somebody like Danny Dyer and some East End boozer talking about a bunch of naughty geezers and you're away. But it can't be denied that a lot of people made a lot of money and had a great time enjoying the cash they made. Some went to prison for quite a long time and came out a multimillionaire, and others went to prison for a short time and have come out a multimillionaire. Now, I appreciate I'm in a minority here, but I don't quite see the point of sending them to prison when they're not violent men. I know you may disagree. But what does really annoy me is that they can now live the rest of their lives as rich men due to their crimes which they were convicted. I mean, look at Barron. Almost £30 million, they find £100,000. Really? It doesn't seem at all right to me, does it you? And if you say they should go to prison because it's a deterrent, let me ask you this. Even though prison is a horrible, scary place for many people, I bet most of us would be willing to spend a year or two there if we knew that on release we would never have to work again and live our lives in comparative luxury. Or maybe you wouldn't. What do you think? Either way, it's just another of many drugs gangs. We've lost the war on drugs, as we all know. And as soon as one is removed, there's always another one looking to break through to take their place with another ingenious new method or just one of the usual old ones. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the UK True Crime Podcast. To discuss this story and any other aspect of UK true crime, please head to Facebook and join over 92,000 of us who talk UK true crime 24/7. And please head to uktruecrime.com, go to the events page, and get your tickets for South Shields and Birmingham. It's going to be great. And to support the show, please do head to patreon.com/uktruecrime for 78 full-length bonus episodes. The latest extended episode came out just yesterday. A huge thank you to the latest members of this community. That's Steve Roberts, Natasha Rowe, Brian B, Abigail Stokoe, Luke Underdown, and Sean Fitzsimmons. Thank you so much. Your support is just so much appreciated. And remember, there is just one more week to win backstage tickets for my upcoming show in South Shields, which you can only win via Patreon. So come and join us at patreon.com/UKTrueCrime. Okay, so that's all for me for another week. So until we speak again next Tuesday, please do take it easy. And remember, despite all the others, stay classy. Cheerio for now.